When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey there, if you would like ad-free and early versions of these episodes, as well as bonus episodes, movie club episodes, and lots more, head on over to patreon.com/Craig and Friends.
It's whimsically volatile.
So before we do our traditional intro, we were just saying how excited we are. Jake, would you please continue what you were saying?
It's so funny, we've been talking about this for years.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And we've always said, like, there's got to be a way that we
can have lunch with Jessica Harper. That's what we kept saying.
Turns out all you have to do is call me. Not that hard.
Dear listeners, on this episode of Whimsically Volatile, our guest is an actor, author, singer, songwriter, and fellow podcaster. You've seen her in such films as Shock Treatment, Minority Report, Inserts, Pennies from Heaven, Stardust Memories, Suspiria, as well as Suspiria. Please join me and my special guest co-host, Jake Shears, in welcoming none other than the Krabby Cook herself, Jessica Harper.
Haven't been called the Krabby Cook in a long time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Now, the Krabby Cook is your cookbook, right? With some anecdotes and a bit of a memoir sort of take on it.
Yeah. It's telling a whole lot about my family and their terrible eating habits.
What were their terrible eating habits? Or did you change them, or did they remain terrible?
No, they've morphed over the years. Uh-huh. They're now, in some cases, equally terrible, but totally different form. So like when my daughters were little, and they went through the phase where they would only eat food that was white, which, I mean, it's a short list.
Yeah, it is.
We did that for a period, actually.
That's right. That's right.
Did you?
Thin White Duke period, he only would consume things that were white.
Yeah.
Really?
With his, though, it was cocaine, milk,
probably.
And then he snuck in some green peppers.
Right.
Though.
Okay.
Yeah,
so maybe a little different from your daughters.
I was pretty strict about the cocaine when they were four.
Eight and above, right? Yeah.
Right, exactly. Just wait till you're 10.
How did you introduce new foods to picky kids?
I disguised things, for one thing. Like when I say white food, they would draw the line at cauliflower, for example.
Mm. Oh, okay.
So you mash it up, like in a food process, make it look like mashed potatoes.
Yeah.
And then they would eat it.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, there used to be another cookbook out, Jerry Seinfeld's wife.
Oh, that's
remember?
Right. Yeah.
She made a thing about how you hide vegetables.
You sneak the broccoli in through the brownie, something like that.
Right, which was totally disgusting. No, actually, I think, but my daughters were too smart for that. They could sniff out broccoli from across the room.
Yeah, that's pretty easy to detect, but some mashed cauliflower.
Mashed cauliflower. Beyond that, you just kind of had to wait it out until they go. And then finally they would eat, you could use tomato sauce. That took several years because it was red, of course, and we can't be anything.
Sure.
Red or green were off the menu. You know, and one by one, a color gets introduced.
Okay, so that's like every few years?
Yeah, every few years you'd get a color going. Of course, brown, being related to chocolate, was an early pleaser.
That was an easy one?
Yeah, that was pretty easy.
Did you always cook since you were young, or?
No.
when did you start cooking?
I became food obsessed when I was in my 20s.
Mm-hmm.
I started cooking Italian food. Little did I know how much Italian culture would be in my future. Speaking of like movie stuff.
Yeah.
Having done Suspiria twice, for example.
Yeah. Right. And the director of the reimagining, how do you pronounce his name?
Luca Guadagnino.
And I butchered it out on the steps.
It took me forever to get it, to nail it.
Jake, what were you going to say?
It's amazing to think about all of the things that you've done. And also going back and listening to your podcast, you've made this memoir podcast called I just thought it was just amazing to hear about growing up and your childhood and just thinking about this awesome life that you've had, and only this sort of memoir that you've made and very creatively, might I add, with interviews with your family. Mm-hmm. It's beautifully done piece of work.
Thank you so much.
And scored completely
by...
And scored.
You know, as far as you know, all the music that you've recorded and your children's books. When did that sort of leg start?
Well, now which leg are we talking about?
Just like as far as just as far as recording children's music and writing songs. And like, and really when did that whole aspect start?
That occurred at the same time as the white food. So that was like when I had daughters back to back basically. Mm-hmm. And I love being a mom. I still do. Now they're millennials and they're fabulous.
Mm-hmm. What are their names?
Nora and Elizabeth. So when they were little, and I really wanted to spend as much time with them as I could because I wanted to, you know, just wanted to be a mom. My husband had a very busy job. I wanted to be in the house. Mm-hmm. So I cut back on other kind of work. But I read them stories and we listened to so-called children's music. And I found that a whole lot of it was kind of terrible.
Yeah.
So I don't mean to be mean to anybody, but some of it was fabulous.
Yeah. Who were the ones you liked?
I don't know if you guys listened to like The Little Mermaid or Beauty and the Beast.
Oh my God.
Any of those.
I mean, A Little Mermaid especially is like,
it's fantastic.
It's kind of a real gay classic. Mm-hmm. Among people of all ages. But yeah. I feel like my generation definitely, sure. You know, you put Little Mermaid on in front of any, you know, 40-year-old gay man and they watch
dance.
Him go. Yeah. Watch him go.
Yeah. It's fantastic. The lyrics are incredible.
Yeah.
And so when I had a desperate moment with the children, I always put on one of those videos because it was harmless enough. Mm-hmm. We were very strict about TV and along with the cocaine. So
they get hopped up and watching all the channels,
right.
You know.
So we didn't let them watch much TV or we didn't allow video games, but the Disney stuff was so lovely. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of that, which I thought was fantastic. And then Marlo Thomas did a beautiful album for children featuring a lot of fabulous
people. Free to Be You and Me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought that was really
That's
great.
A wonderful one. And also that song, I think as the podcast had posted that song at the beginning of Pride Month. Because it works in many contexts.
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
And then there was a lot that I just didn't like. And so I got inspired because I'd already been a songwriter. I wrote some songs for Bette Midler and this and that.
Yeah, Soda and a Souvenir, right?
Soda and a Souvenir, and she sang a couple other ones. And so I started writing songs for them, for the mm-hmm. kids. And you can hear their voices in some of the recordings, and I brought in their friends, and it was like one of those kind of organic things. Suddenly I had 7 albums of music.
You know, we've never had babies. Mm-hmm. I've never had babies, but I do, and I know that it's different, but I do have a little dog named Toby. And and
he's also strict with Toby's cocaine.
Right.
Toby is not allowed to do any coke until he's 13. He's 12.
Right.
But I imagine it would be, you know, when you're hanging out with the kids all day and it's kind of in a certain way, like I'll be around the house, mm-hmm. you know, with the dog and I'm sure you're sort of talking to them and then, you know, singing bonkers songs. I know if I had kids, I would be singing just some weird stuff. And then you got to be like, hey, that's not half bad. And the kids are singing along with me. So
right.
I've got to put this down.
Right. It does kind of go that way. It comes out of, and also listening to, they have the greatest minds.
Mm-hmm.
They're just insane.
They say some funny shit.
They're
kids.
Insane. They say some funny shit. And so they say stuff and it just triggers an idea.
Yeah.
So I stole a lot from my children.
Yeah, you've got that's a good way. You can get great lines from kids. I mean, I write a lot of songs and you know, it's a lot of them come from eavesdropping and mm-hmm. I imagine kids are a great
they're incredible.
Resource for that. They say some bonkers.
Yeah, and do some stuff like the day Nora took her friend into her room, my little daughter when she was like 3 and she had a guy friend and they went in and destroyed her room basically.
Trashed it.
And I started writing this song called Something's Going On in Nora's Room. And it became this crash, bang, boom, you know, and it became this sort of signature song for her and for all the stuff I was doing at the time. And then it turned it into a children's book as well. So,
and she was sort of taking after you running out. There's a great story on Winnetka of you as a small child running out on your rooftop naked.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Having
yeah.
to be cajoled back in, which actually sounded so frightening.
Yeah.
It was.
So scary.
I liked when they said, well, we didn't want to show how upset we were because we just right. were trying to keep you calm.
Right, exactly.
To get you in.
Yeah, the minister who, from the church next door calls my parents. And this is a Sunday morning. All the parishioners are filing into the church.
Hmm.
And they're kind of looking up at the roof. And there were three children dancing naked on the roof. Three children under the age of five. And we were having the best time.
I'm sure.
You know how liberating it is to dance on a roof? It's like...
Naked.
No clothing. So fun. My parents come to the window and see us out there. And they're just like, you know, they didn't want to scare us
yeah.
with their fury, which we experienced a little later.
Yeah. Sure, yeah.
But... otherwise, we might just topple right off.
Well, if you startle in that situation.
Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we got in, and then we got the big spanking.
Was it your brother who termed the tools of the trade the weapons of ass destruction?
Yeah, right. I really like that line. I like that line. It sounds like it. I mean, I don't mean to be crass, but it sounds like a great porno movie title.
I know. It does,
you
actually.
Yeah, it does.
Mention it.
Great dance track as well,
yeah,
right. You know, for your side project. Yeah.
Right.
But with the spanking, there was some heavy discipline in your household growing up.
Yeah, well, it was the 50s,
mm-hmm.
and this was kind of, you know, people spanked people.
Yeah.
I mean, usually adults spanking children, but not exclusively. And it was kind of a normal thing.
Sure.
Nobody really took into account until later how terrifying that was for children.
Right.
And how it could really impact, you know, a parent's relationship with it. Yeah, so... several of us in my family got kind of messed up behind all the spanking, but I'm sure many of our generation did, and then others didn't so much. Didn't
sure.
care.
With the podcast that you put out, writing everything down and really kind of compiling and taking stock from your family, and what were the biggest challenges of that?
Well, if you have five siblings, it's like herding cats. Mm-hmm. You have to. They were more. Most of them really willing. To talk, which first of all surprised me.
Mm-hmm. How come?
Well, because they told some really personal stuff.
Right.
You know, my brother would say, well, Dad loved me, but he didn't like me. You know, just things that surprised when the rest of my siblings heard it all.
Sure.
They said, geez, really?
Heavy stuff.
And also because of how you described the limit on emotional expression.
This was WASP land where I grew up. Winnetka, Illinois, mm-hmm. suburb of Chicago. For those listeners who don't know, it looks like, I don't even know if anybody remembers the reference to Ozzie and Harriet anymore, but...
Is that where they were? I know, I remember Ozzie and Harriet. Is that where they were stationed?
I don't think it's actually where they were stationed, but you know where, you know what was a movie was shot there was, is the movie Home Alone.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
So if everybody just fix that in your mind, that's the neighborhood.
Okay. That's a perfect image.
Got
to,
it.
Yeah.
So, and in our day, everybody wore Madras shorts.
Mm-hmm.
You know those Nantucket red pants men wear when they're WASPy?
Oh, yeah.
We had a lot of those. It was a very country club town.
Yeah.
Very well-kept lawns. Mm-hmm. And very white.
Yeah.
And white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, to be more precise. That's where I grew up. And that's what this podcast is all about.
Yeah.
It's also about the era that was the the 50s going into the 60s. And
also to go back to what you were saying before mm-hmm. about being a stay-at-home mom, the attitudes about stay-at-home moms were rather different when your mom was a stay-at-home mom.
When I was a stay-at-home mom, I wasn't exactly a stay-at-home mom.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I still was working some. Like when I had my first baby, I went right into the Gary Shandling show.
Right.
So I took my little six-week-old baby with me.
Sure. So slightly different.
So it's
circumstances.
A different vibe. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know that my mother would have been encouraged.
She wasn't on the Gary Shandling
no.
show, right?
So, my mother says in the podcast, I mean, she was really smart and well educated. You know, she went to Bryn Mawr College.
Mm-hmm.
She felt that, you know, that there wasn't enough respect for what this job entailed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she loved being with the kids. And she had, God knows, a lot of them. She had six, two sets of twins. And she enjoyed it, but she always felt a little bit bad about being in that position. Which she said was kind of too bad. I mean, why just let me enjoy this.
Yeah.
But because, you know, the job of the man to go off in his fedora and get on the train and mm-hmm. go to Chicago was much more respected.
Sure.
And valued publicly.
Valued.
It seemed like what she was saying, it just seems like the work, all that work that she did, just wasn't valued as much as the men's.
It was taken for granted. And
right.
Yeah.
And let's face it, there's still a lot of that now.
Sure.
But I do think it's gotten better that people have much more publicly expressed how valuable it is mm-hmm. that there is one of the parents is able to be home and doing the heavy lifting.
Right.
And how heavy that lifting is, by the way.
Yeah.
You know, it's the craziest job there is, mm-hmm. really, when you think about it. The most responsibility, you know.
Bad hours, too.
And lousy hours from the get-go. You're just exhausted.
And you've had some crazy jobs.
Yeah.
You've had some crazy jobs. I mean,
you have
been in some of the best movies
this is true.
Ever.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ever.
I'm so glad you say that.
When we talk about the idea of when we would say, someday we have to have lunch with Jessica Harper, we would just always go back to the thing where we're like, how can someone be in Stardust Memories, Shock Treatment, and Phantom of the Paradise? Because Phantom of the Paradise is one of our absolute favorites.
And Shock Treatment.
Well, Shock Treatment, of course. This is the thing. Like, yeah. you start talking about it. Yeah. And also, it's interesting that both of you worked with Paul Williams.
Yes.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. You know, we're both massive Paul Williams fans. And
wow.
I think it's the first conversation we actually had was about Paul Williams.
Yeah. Wow. And he, to me, is like one of, with all the music that I've made over the years, he's always been one of the biggest touchstones for me. I feel like he's one of my biggest influences.
Yeah.
Really?
With all the music that I write. Yeah. And I just made an album that just came out last year. And I mean, still to this day, you know, I've been writing songs for 20 years mm-hmm. and he's so present in my music.
Wow.
But I reached out, it was about 2006. And we wrote a bunch of songs together and just became friends. And mm-hmm. he's just such an amazing man.
Isn't he?
He's just wonderful.
He is wonderful.
Phantom of the Paradise. Talk for a second about just your memories of
your first movie. Right?
My first movie.
Wasn't it? Right? Yeah.
Yeah,
okay, so, I want to make sure that was right.
Yeah, no, it's like, how do you remember auditioning for it?
Yes. A part of that audition I blacked out, but the rest of it I remember quite well.
Were you nervous?
What happened was that I was in an off-Broadway show that was one of those things in New York where it got a great review from Clive Barnes, who was the critic at the top critic at the mm-hmm. time. So everybody in New York went, you know, mm-hmm. like everybody goes to those. So, you know, like Woody Allen's reps were there and Brian De Palma saw it and this one's. And so out of that, I got this incredible rush of interest. So I get Brian De Palma, you know, calling me up to come and sing for Paul. And, you know.
Oh my God.
And I know, right?
Holy
and
mackerel.
Go up there and he had me sing Superstar.
Mm.
That song that.
Oh, the Carpenters?
The Karen
song?
Carpenters. Mm. I think it's a Leon Russell song.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
And oddly, not one of his own songs. I think it was, I sang Superstar. Anyway, and I went up and sang for Paul, which was very nerve wracking, as you can imagine.
Sure.
And this was in New York. He liked me enough to say, all right, we're going to bring you to L.A. for a screen test. And I flashback on all these movies I'd seen in the 40s, you know, where your Katharine Hepburn or somebody is having a screen test.
Yeah. Flash bulbs and then the montage.
Right. And then the next thing you know, they're on the red carpet.
Yeah.
So I was already mentally on the red carpet. I went out to, they flew me out to L.A. and put me at the Sunset Marquee, not the Sunset Marquee, the Chateau Marmont.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Famous old beautiful hotel, which mm-hmm. made me feel once more like I was in one of those flashbacks to Judy Garland.
Yeah.
This is the part where I started to black out. The next morning, they took me to a place, and I was competing with Linda Ronstadt.
Oh, wow.
So I was really intimidated.
Whoa.
There was a couple of other people, too.
Yeah.
But I had, when they said LR, I went, oh, my God. This is so not going to happen.
How do they tell you that? Did they mention it sort of casually, or they're like, by the way, you're up against?
Actually, it was after, I believe, that Brian told me.
Okay.
I don't think I knew that before going in.
Uh-huh.
He told me afterwards.
Mm-hmm. That's a smart one, because it's just intimidating.
It could have been,
You know that record we were listening to? You're going to be up against them.
I know. And, So we go to the thing and to a little studio, and they ask me to sing again, and then I guess I did some speaking as well. But again, I can't, this is where I get very vague. And then afterwards, we went to dinner at Mousson Frank's restaurant, that classic old restaurant. Oh, yeah. Listeners may not know.
Well, listeners may be familiar with it if they go to see Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Right.
Yeah.
They will be. And we sat at a round table and he said, okay, I want you to meet my friend. And his name is Marty Scorsese. So Scorsese. This was unbelievable.
Yeah.
Of course, I didn't know who that was or would become at that time. But this was, you know, back in ancient 70s. So, but then the costume designer came in the middle of dinner and dragged me into the ladies' room and said, I need to measure you.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a feeling that was a good sign.
Yeah.
Either right. That or she's just a really weird person.
She had to know everyone's
she
measurements.
She was measuring everybody in the restaurant. So then I flew home the next day, and then I got a phone call shortly after that from Brian saying I had the part, and it was like a miracle.
I can imagine. Yeah.
Yeah, it was obviously a life changer.
Well, yeah. And wasn't the shooting of the film a little bit arduous?
I wouldn't say arduous. I would say it was a little challenging for a person like me who never set foot on a movie set before.
And it's a musical. There's a lot of
yes.
things going on.
Yes. Well, there was that. And I had to sing live. And the first day of shooting, I had to sing live.
Oh.
Because I was, you know, ostensibly, I was in an audition scene.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And so I had to sing on this big spiral staircase with William Finley. And then I had to get raped by a 400-pound man in the same day. It was a Harvey Weinstein scene.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
With featuring George Memoli, who was wonderful in the movie. R.I.P. George. Anyway, but, you know, like, hit your marks. And I didn't, I'm like, who's Mark? I don't know. I just didn't know the language.
Yeah, sure.
But William Finley, who starred in the movie, also played the Phantom. Was very sweet and very helpful. And anytime I didn't know what I was doing, which was every 6 or 7 minutes, he would say, no, you're doing great, Messiah. Just walk over there. When they say hit the mark, just walk over to where that red tape, you know, like that kind of thing. It was actually really fun, the shoot. We were in Dallas, which maybe you don't associate with fun all the time. But.
I feel like in the 70s, a lot of places were had, I don't know.
Like
I feel
fun.
Like Dallas would have been fun in the 70s. I mean, come on.
I guess so. Chicken fried steak and yeah. I think I still had a Kennedy assassination hangover. That's why I didn't think of it.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Because we drove by the grassy knoll and all those, you know.
It's a mood setter.
Iconic places. Exactly. Yeah. It's a mood setter.
And what was the follow-up movie from after that?
Well, then I got a cluster... Oh, I'm not going to say that word.
That's okay. We welcome that word.
You can say clusterfuck?
Yep, absolutely, yes. Yeah. Well, I'll say clusterfuck. 1, 2, 3.
Clusterfuck.
Okay. Oh, I got that out. So Dario Argento saw Phantom of the Paradise, and he was casting this movie, Suspiria, this crazy horror movie.
Mm.
He was regarded as sort of the Hitchcock of Italy at the time.
Right.
You know, his movies were doing very well and were very scary. At the same moment, Woody Allen offered me a part in Annie Hall. I think I had already done Love and Death, though. I'd already done a small part in Love and Death with Woody Allen. And then he called about Annie Hall. And it was exactly at the same time as Suspiria. And my agent convinced me that I should do Suspiria instead, which, in retrospect, I think was a great choice. At the time, I was really torn.
What was the part? If you recall, in Annie Hall.
It was not a big part. It was played by Shelley Duvall.
She
played a Rolling Stone reporter.
Right. I think you made the better choice.
You made the right choice.
Yeah, you definitely did.
It wasn't, yeah. Well, and then, of course, it came back full circle 40 years later with Luca Guadagnino's Suspiria. So it was, that's been a great, wonderful kind of thing.
As a fan, it was so exciting to see you in the new Suspiria. I mean, it really, like, I usually don't have moments in a movie theater where I'm like, oh my God! but it was really, it was thrilling. I absolutely loved the new Suspiria.
I loved it. I thought it was kind of great.
It was so fucking cool.
I know, crazy.
It's a crazy movie, and I loved so much that you were a part of it and in it. And
I loved doing that.
Tell us about shooting it. I mean, it was probably shot, what, 2 years ago?
16 into 17, I think, was when we shot. And I was only, as you know, my part is very small. It's really just a kind of a reference to the other movie. But and I shot with Tilda Swinton, who in the movie she was playing three different characters.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
One of which was this 70-something-year-old psychiatrist, mm-hmm. male psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. And for very many months, they pretended that it was this German actor, this his first job, and you know, there was a whole news story around this actor. Eventually, that, of course, with the internet, you can't keep that secret. But anyway, she was incredible.
What a tripper she is. I've gotten to hang out with her a couple times, I just thought uh-huh. she was just like, she's just the coolest.
Yeah, there's nobody cooler than mm-hmm.
and
that.
Her in the Bowie videos.
Yeah.
It's really
fantastic. That was awesome. Yeah. Did you have some kind of full circle feelings?
Oh, absolutely. A really good full circle.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it was so surprising, really, when I went to the set for the first day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there were a lot of actors there, as you know, that many of the scenes are widely populated with dancers and so on. Mm-hmm. So they were all kind of gathered and, you know, doing their makeup and so on. I walked in and they all went, because it was, and I realized, oh, yeah, I guess it was just this. It was so sweet.
Yeah.
And Tilda came up and, oh my God, it's so cool that you're in this movie. And I just felt like a superstar for mm-hmm. for a minute. It was really fun.
Well, I can imagine.
Yeah, because they had all, of course, they'd all seen and adored the movie, the other version.
And about the other version, shooting that looked like it must have been really interesting, especially the scene with the maggots.
Oh yeah, that was a good day.
No, wish all days could be like that on the set, right?
Yeah, I know. Close encounter with a wiggly white worm. Well, what happened was Dario, he came up to me on this day we were shooting. Came up to me on the set and he had a little paper like a sandwich bag. Mm-hmm. And he came up to me and he pulled it right up to my face and opened it, and inside were all these wriggling maggots. And I just screamed.
I'll be right back. I'm just going to go vomit. But yeah. Anyway,
The truth is that in the actual shooting, the stuff falling in my hair was rice.
Oh, okay. So it was just
we had to draw the line at the
good.
The white food.
Yeah. Did he play music on the set?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
He played it quite a lot because at the time, and I don't know to what degree this is still ever the case in Italy, mm-hmm. but at the time they didn't really record a lot of actual sound.
Sure, yeah.
You know, everything just got looped after.
Mm-hmm.
So there wasn't that much regard for how much dialogue they were actually catching or whether there was noise obscuring it or whatever. So, he would play the Goblin music, which for listeners, you should listen to Goblin if you haven't ever. Play it on Halloween.
We actually did a movie club episode fully on Suspiria.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, it was actually, I think, longer than the actual film because we're kind of obsessed with the film and the score.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
It is.
Yeah, so he played that to inspire us and we just acted right over it or whatever. Yeah.
Again, mood setter for sure, right?
Total mood setter. Fantastic mood setter.
One time I chased some punks who were smoking weed, stinky weed. I'm fine with people smoking weed outside, but it was really stinky.
Just gross smelling or just, what? Just
like the worst smelling, skunky, garbagey.
Yeah.
And the windows in this place are not terrific. So it was just coming in. And so I just put the Suspiria soundtrack on and rolled the speaker out there.
Wow.
Took care of it. Although I tried it again with someone else and they stayed.
They enjoyed it.
Yeah.
They started dancing. They just started doing interpretive dances.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
You're
You're
a creep.
Yeah. Let's hang out.
Like, who is this person?
Right. Right. Was that the first time that you shot a film in that way with the sort of no regard to dialogue and also with people speaking different languages, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I'd never had that experience. And yes, so I did a scene, for example, with an elderly German gentleman who's sort of the counterpart of Tilda's part in the in Luca's version.
The one who explains the paranormal stuff to Susie, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I spoke my lines in English and he spoke his in German. And I don't speak German, but I just nodded. I mean, obviously, I sort of vaguely knew what he was saying. But that happened a fair amount.
Because that's a classic acting technique, right? They say, just don't even listen to the other person. Just wait till they stop talking.
Right. Wait till he kicks you under the table and then speak.
Like Woody Allen, similar direction, right? Just, right. Just don't worry what they're saying. Just wait. Right. And right. So you first worked with him on Love and Death in 73, 74?
Something like that. I sort of forget. Yeah.
And then later in Stardust Memories, it's a much more intense role, larger role.
Right, yeah.
And that film was kind of notorious at the time because people freaked out about it.
Yeah, people didn't like it so much. I thought it was a great movie.
It's my favorite Woody Allen.
Is it really?
Movie. Yeah. It's actually the favorite also of our friend John Grant, who's a fabulous singer. Oh. We have a couple comments from John that we're going to play. We'll start with one now.
Oh my God, I love that John Grant.
Isn't that fabulous?
Yeah.
He was so excited about this episode too.
Hi, Jessica. My name is John Grant. And I'm a huge fan, but I have been trying to lose weight. My question for you is, what kind of secret superiority do you feel deep inside that must be kept secret and kept from the rest of the public, as far as being from the Midwest and knowing that that gives you a leg up in this world because people from the Midwest are the greatest? Thank you.
He's a very serious guy. Yeah.
Is John from the Midwest?
John is actually, I think. Yeah, Michigan, right? Isn't he? I believe.
Is he?
Yeah.
Michigan?
Yeah.
Well, I do say with a great deal of pride when people ask me, I'm from Chicago. And just listen to that. I said, and. Like, in case you didn't know, I was from Chicago. I do, and I'm with John. I mean, we are kind of special people. Mm-hmm. We Midwesterners, I like to think. You know, I've been living on one coast or the other for many, many years, but but I take greater pride in saying I'm from Chicago.
Hmm.
Partly because people go, oh.
Oh, they act surprised.
You get a little reaction. If you say you're from LA, they go, oh. New York, they go, huh. It's kind of a surprise for some reason.
Surprise, and also they know that you can handle yourself in a fight.
Exactly. And then I know a good pizza when I see one.
I've lived in New York and LA and Seattle and run all, you know, London and Chicago is just one of those places that I kind of like dream about. I've always had just a fantastic time. There's a great gay scene and the Lollapalooza that they've been having in Chicago the last 10 years or so is an absolute hoot.
Speaking of Lollapalooza, are you aware of the pocket of fans who live in Winnipeg?
I actually went to one of those.
The Phantom Palooza?
I went to one of those, yeah. I stupidly drove, and I did not realize what an ordeal that would be.
Quite how far it was.
Yes, I was living in Massachusetts at the time as well.
Oh, okay.
And I had to go, I remember at one point going into Canada, you had to go back into Michigan and go back up to Canada again.
Oh, geez.
But it was already that far into it, and so... Yeah, so there's this thing, Jason. Oh, sorry. There's this thing, Jake, called, what is Phantom Palooza, right?
Yeah, Phantom Palooza.
Phantom Palooza. And there's a documentary coming out now, I think, about the phenomenon. So when Phantom of the Paradise was released, it only really did well in, I think, Paris and Winnipeg.
No, there was also somewhere in South America. I think it was Brazil or something.
Wow, really?
Yeah, these random pockets of extreme activity.
Yeah, and it ran in Winnipeg, I think, for at least a year, maybe 2 years.
Oh, forever.
Yeah, it was like the number one movie in Winnipeg.
It was the number one. They lined up, and I went to one of the Phantom Paloozas.
Uh-huh.
I think maybe it was the first one. And Paul went, and everybody went. You'd think we were the Beatles.
Right, yeah.
And it was really, it was
like the whole town goes bananas.
The whole
cool.
It's their thing, and it's so cool. It's really, really
How
sweet.
Fun.
We should go to one sometime.
I would love that.
That would be a lot of fun.
I would love that.
Because they had the band, like everyone, even the Howard Oblong and all those guys sang, right? Yeah, everyone with the makeup and and everyone performed, right?
Yeah, I even unexpectedly performed.
Yeah.
Oh, come on, Jessica, sing Old Souls. Well, I haven't sung it in 40 years. That's all right. You can do it.
Do you ever sing out live?
No.
Mm-hmm. Why not?
I don't, you know,
I would love if you did like a
cabaret
show.
Style.
Yeah, like a cabaret style show would be amazing.
It would be amazing, yeah.
Thank you for saying that. I'll take it under consideration.
Seriously.
I think,
because I've actually thought, I've been thinking about, it's crossed my mind the last couple of days since, you know, I knew that we were doing this. Mm. I think that would be, I would love to see and go hear you sing and do a show where you could talk about don't know, tell stories and sing some songs. I think that would be...
You're good at both, telling stories and songs, right? So singing songs, not telling songs. But although I'm sure you'd be good at that too, right?
Because I really like being in the recording studio because you have, you know, complete control over what comes out of your mouth.
I like also that in the credits for your show, you're like, this show was edited and produced by me. Well, because, you know, I have the same kind of thing about the control over the final product and editing and everything.
Right.
So I relate to that. And also there's a distinct vision to your show.
Right.
But there could be with the live show too. I think that would be really good. And also, I mean, we'd all flip to hear like Looking for Trade live and then mixed with all the other stuff. Yeah.
I would storm the stage. I would storm the stage. Freak demand out. To sing with you.
Well, listen, Jake Shears featuring Jessica Harper. I think that'd be a terrific single.
God.
Yeah.
I think so.
Mm.
Well, I don't know. Life is long. Maybe I'll come around to it again. Mm. I have a little stage fright, I think, as I get older.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
When did that creep in, or did you have that when you did Hair?
No, I don't remember having that when I did Hair. Although one night I understudied the lead and I had to go on.
Oof, that's terrible.
And that was terrible, especially if you've literally had no rehearsal. And this is the actor's nightmare. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you've heard this cliche. You dream and have a dream that somebody's handing you a script and saying you have to go on in 20 minutes. And that's actually kind of what happened. Luckily, I had been paying enough attention. And my role is, I was kind of in the chorus and I got to sing songs like Black Boys Are Delicious.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if that song would, if they'd get away with that now. Yeah, talk about a great score. That
yeah.
Was
oh my really God.
It's a phenomenal score.
That was
score.
A great
yeah.
show. So I was terrified that night and I've had other nights of terror, but...
Nights of Terror could be the name of your show.
Yes. It could be...
Jessica Harper presents Nights of Terror. Yeah.
Yeah, could be the title of my autobiography. No, but Hair was a crazy experience. So this was my first audition ever. I was 19. And my mother called me. I was kind of in between colleges.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I was a dropout. And my mother called me and she said, you know, I had already started kind of singing and playing around in theater classes mm-hmm. and stuff. You know, they're auditioning people for the chorus of Hair. You should go. So I said, okay, whatever, because I was doing nothing except dropping out.
Yeah.
So I thought, what have I got to lose? I went to this. And my boyfriend drove me in this beat up old yellow Honda down from Connecticut, where we were, to this church downtown in New York, and there were hippies lined up around the block, 500 hippies,
mm-hmm.
all of them strumming guitars and wearing love beads and smoking dope. And one by one, we go in, and I went in finally with my boyfriend accompanying me. I sang Heartbreak Hotel, which seemed like an obvious choice. And they said, oh, that's good. And what about your boyfriend? Can he sing? And so they had him sing.
Mm-hmm.
And then we both got into the show.
Oh, wow. Wow.
So it was another little miracle. I feel like I'm really a very, very lucky person.
Well, and also you can be the challenge as well. That's the other thing.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
What was it like being in a show with your boyfriend?
We broke up shortly after. Short-lived affair.
That sounds intense.
Mm.
Yeah, then we just stayed on opposite sides of the stage as much as possible after that. Yeah, it was intense.
Yeah.
Did everyone get nude during that show?
If you got nude... They mm-hmm. paid you an extra $2.50 a night. And I have always said, I have my price. So I got nude every night. Not everybody did, or if you weren't in the mood, you didn't, you know, wasn't, you weren't punished if you didn't. But
oh, well, that's good, yeah.
It was encouraged.
You didn't seem to have any trouble with that, with inserts or, let me rephrase
or
that.
Or on the rooftop
that sounds
as a yeah, 5-year-old.
Right, from the roof, from the rooftop to pennies from
been
heaven.
There, done that, not a problem.
Yeah. Oh, actually, let's talk about Pennies from Heaven for a little bit, because that's a really fascinating movie that kind of flopped when it came out.
Yeah, it's a bomb. Let's just call it what it was.
Sure, because it's an incredibly depressing movie. It's beautiful. But it's very sad.
It's gorgeous. It's such a psychedelically mind-blowingly beautiful movie.
Isn't it gorgeous?
It's shocking, really. Yeah.
Yeah. There's one scene in particular that always stays with me. That scene where Vernell Banner is this beautiful African American dancer / actor who does a dance. I can't even describe this beautiful dance he does.
With the gold things in the air?
Pennies
floating
down. Yeah,
right, the pennies.
And it's to the song of Pennies from Heaven, which is a gorgeous song. And it's, there were moments like that in the movie that are just so beautiful.
It almost looks like there's a special effect going on because the way his body is moving is unreal.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah, he was a gorgeous, gorgeous dancer. And Christopher Walken doing a tap dance on the bar. I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah. There is some really great stuff. I think, I wonder if it came out now, if it would have, once people got more used to the idea of Steve Martin doing more serious stuff. I think he was fresh off of
The Jerk, maybe?
The Jerk.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm not sure. I don't know if that's what the problem was, but maybe people weren't. And because he was great in the movie, too.
Everyone's wonderful in it.
I loved that movie.
It was high concept.
Yeah,
It was a lofty concept. And I think sometimes. Often it takes people a while to come around to movies that try something different. I mean, we're sitting here under poster for Tommy and Body Double,
which was a huge bomb. Controversial bomb when it came out. There was a 3-picture deal, I think, that De Palma had at Columbia, and then as soon as that came out, they wanted to get rid of him and the movie.
And it's in my top 5. I mean, after all these movies that really try to do something different and break through the mold. I think it just takes, they're the ones that end up really becoming the classics.
And it's so much harder now, as we know, to do anything. My husband works in the movie business, and they're at Sony, they have Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And the whole thing about that was, you know, can we take a piece of new intellectual property, something original, instead of the 8th sequel to Spider-Man? Mm-hmm. And will it work?
Yeah.
It's become so hard to do that.
Because it seems like every other movie is either a reimagining or Spider-Man's origin tale again.
Right.
Something like that.
Anything else remotely like that is on, you know, Netflix or streaming.
Sure.
Somewhere. So for the movie business, it's really, really hard to do. It's hard to get any studio to do anything like that.
I'm really tight with Larry Mark, who works for Sony.
Yeah.
I'm sure you probably
know him.
And you'll have to bring him on the show. That's the other thing.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
That would be.
So, but I met him through, I was writing initial stuff for Greatest Showman. I mean, there's an example of something that they really just worked and worked and worked on it. And it took them forever. And, you know, look at it. It was so crazy how that happened. And when it came out, it was not doing well for a few weeks.
Right.
And it just became a massive, massive, massive hit. Mm-hmm.
It's great. We just saw Hugh Jackman at the Hollywood Bowl, and he does so many songs from the show.
Yeah.
And everybody is just on their feet.
That's so fun.
People go nuts for that movie, and it's so great.
Yes,
that musicals are working again.
Yeah.
And, you know, with Rocket Man as well.
Yes.
I mean, Larry was saying the other day, he was saying there's 4 things that are working now, and it's horror movies, superhero movies, I can't remember what the third was, and musicals.
Basically,
I don't know, 4 genres.
Yeah.
So, was it dog pictures that he was saying? I don't know.
Maybe
Christian films.
Christian dogs. Christian dog pictures.
Well, they basically are.
Essentially.
Dog pictures are.
I mean, if they could get a horror superhero musical happening, which actually kind of Phantom of the Paradise is kind of, maybe they could
featuring
reimagine.
Featuring a dog.
Yes, right, exactly.
And a Christian.
What about, speaking of superhero horror movie musicals, tell us about your experience with Shock Treatment, which is just one of my favorite movies of all time, and it's one of my favorite scores.
I love the music.
The music is so good.
So
both of you have worked with Richard O'Brien.
Oh, really?
I mean, I did a show with him. I did a big Rocky Horror tribute at Brixton Academy. This is years ago.
Oh,
it was for
great.
Halloween. It was just a big concert. And it was fantastic.
A
fucking great time.
Yeah.
But, you know, and I love talking to him about Shock Treatment. What was your experience like with that movie? And how do you feel about it now?
Gosh, I haven't seen it in a long time now that you mention it. But I loved the music. I just loved it.
And it's a wicked score.
It's really good. And I love the Nell Campbell was just, I just loved her.
Yeah.
And the whole group. And Barry Humphreys. I mean, unbelievable.
For listeners who don't know, that's Dame Edna.
Dame Edna, yeah. And such a gentleman.
Mm-hmm.
And so un-Dame Edna when he's not Dame Edna, and so brilliant when he is Dame Edna. Brilliant in both cases.
And our friend John, actually, John Grant, was I'd shown him Shock Treatment. He hadn't seen it before, and he speaks fluent German and a few other languages, and he was commenting on how Bert Schnick's German is perfect, or like the accent is perfect.
Is that right? Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, of course it is, because it's Barry Humphries.
Barry Humphries. Yeah. he's just like an incredible English, he's Australian, isn't he?
Oh, that's right, he is, isn't he?
Yeah. I was going to say an English gentleman, but he's probably not even English. but you know, just off camera, just elegant and mm-hmm. educated and smart and funny. Working with those people was fantastic, and the music. And I just, you know, living in London just has a great deal of appeal to me.
That's where it was shot. It was shot in London, and yeah. I mean, it's strange. It's a very odd movie because it basically prophesizes reality television.
Yeah.
It's sort of the first. Yeah. As far as I know, it's kind of the first thing that really shows.
I think it is, yeah. Actually, we're going to be doing a movie club on Shock Treatment as well. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's one of our big favorites.
Oh, that's great.
I'll show you. I didn't want to scare you. Behind that poster is a Shock Treatment poster.
Really?
I'll show you now. Hold on.
I just didn't know if you'd open the door. Oh, wait. That's
my
way. Excuse me.
Cool.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a great...
I forgot that you told me you got that.
Oh, I have that. Also, the cassettes on display over there, the 7 inches over on the speaker, and the VHS and CD are over there.
Oh my God, you have much more equipment than I have. I need to get some of these things.
Do you have it on vinyl? Do you still use vinyl?
Yes, I have it on vinyl, which I occasionally use when the record player isn't broken, which happens frequently.
Yeah.
I remember this, just walking down memory lane. It was a Coachella probably about 5 or 6 years ago. And I had rented this big house with some friends. And like we had just thrown this like massive party. We were throwing a party in a warehouse that got canceled. So the whole thing got moved to the house that that we'd rented. And I had been up all night and I had dropped acid at like 8 a.m. And I hadn't gone to bed. And everyone went to Coachella that night.
Okay, yeah.
And I was just too, just like,
that sounds like a lot.
To go to Coachella. And I turned off all the lights. I was in the house by myself. And I put on the Shock Treatment soundtrack from beginning to end.
Oh,
and
my God.
Just did
while you
a
were
performance
tripping?
In the dark. I mean, I think there was still some
residue,
some acid in my veins. And just, but it was such a good time. I had a great time.
Yeah.
We've had many carry-ons at like late at night. We're like, whoever's there has to listen to whatever we want. And it's the Shock Treatment soundtrack.
A lot of the time. Yeah.
Oh,
yes.
Is that right?
Oh, yes. Definitely. That and Paul Williams stuff like Flash and Ordinary Fool and all that. Yeah.
Hello, uglies.
It's us, the Boulay brothers. And we had a question. Are you gay? Because we always like to know if he, she, or they are gay.
You got to experience the 70s and 80s in a lot in Los Angeles, I presume.
Yeah.
What are some of your memories about just what general life was like? I mean, was your lifestyle really wild?
Did you do all like the classic 70s things?
Was it conservative or was it, you know, what was your experience of that time?
I was in New York in the beginning of this era. Mm-hmm. So it's 69 is when I got into the show Hair. I started doing some work off Broadway and I worked with this radical avant-garde director called Richard Foreman.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God.
Do you know Richard Foreman?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, when I lived in New York, I'd go see at the Octagonological Theater.
Ontological.
His shows are amazing.
Yeah.
His shows are incredible. I didn't know that you were in Richard Foreman. You were in Richard Foreman shows?
Yeah.
Oh, that's so cool.
So I did like 3 of his shows.
Amazing. And then, so weird.
And then I know.
In the best way.
But that was kind of the tone of my, you know, youthful experience in New York. I was living down, and I lived in a loft in Soho. I paid $250 a month, you know, in the early 70s. People were just starting to buy up lofts.
Oh, sure.
And it was very, otherwise, quite deserted. But there was these pockets where these artists would, you know, acquire these giant lofts for their work. There was one restaurant on the corner, it was Worcester Street and Prince.
Mm-hmm.
Called Food, and that was pretty much, it was like an outpost, you know.
Yeah.
So it was very early in the Soho days, and then I did this show that I mentioned before that got all that attention. Mm-hmm. Was at the Mercer Arts Center over on Mercer Street, which many years later collapsed.
Oh, where the New York Dolls played, and
oh, yes,
yeah.
Oh, wow. And they played. That was what was happening. It was a multi venue kind of building, uh-huh. Right? So there was a cafe with a stage, mm-hmm. And there was this beautiful waitress there in the cafe named Diane Abbott, who Robert De Niro got a crush on and later married. So he used to be hanging out in the cafe stalking Diane Abbott, and in the other room over here, Patti Smith was opening for the New York Dolls, right. And then the New York Dolls were playing, and then back there we were doing this crazy musical, this Richard Foreman musical, mm-hmm. And so we'd come out when the show ended, and there would be the New York Dolls and Patti Smith and Robert De Niro. So it was like, you know, it was really an incredible time creatively down in Soho and in that area, and all this radical theater going on and all these great artists and, you know, CBGBs and all these great clubs. And I remember, you know, going to Max's Kansas City, and there was, you know, Bob Marley would play in this small venue.
Sure,
you could see all these incredible people on the bottom line. Mm-hmm. At one point, I actually did a gig at the bottom line. I started to develop my own cabaret act.
Yeah, which you're going to revive soon.
I'm going to revive soon. This was like doing jazz songs. And at that time, later, like Carly Simon and people did all these great jazz albums and stuff. Mm-hmm. But at that time, it wasn't really, nobody was doing that
yet.
Except, you know, Peggy Lee. And I had this producer who I was working with, and he contacted the bottom line and said she could do an opening act for somebody. And they said, oh, yeah, we've got just the person. He needs somebody to open for him. He's coming in a couple of weeks. His name is Bruce Springsteen. And so my producer said, you know, I'm not sure that's really going to be a good fit. And he was right, ultimately, I think, because I would have gone out there in my little jazz act and with all the screaming Springsteen fans.
And the fervor that was going on.
I think it might have been a disaster. It was not so great, even as it was later. I ended up opening for Oscar Brown Jr.
Wow.
And so like 7 people showed up. But anyway, so there were a lot of stories around that at that time. And that's how I start. So I was I was a theater girl, mm-hmm. going from show to unemployment lines to... Mm-hmm. You know, living in cheap apartments. That was my life. And it wasn't, I wouldn't say it was wild. I mean, I smoked a lot of dope, but it wasn't wild.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned smoking dope and doing acid in your podcast. Did you ever experiment with any other substances during that time?
Oh, I used to love mescaline, but then I had a bad one.
And that was it for that?
Actually, kind of the it for everything.
Really?
I stopped doing anything like any drugs at all after my mid-20s maybe.
And I'm curious what your relationship with alcohol is because of what you talk about in the podcast about your family history.
Oh, yeah.
With it, and there's a quote. You said in your podcast that you came to think of alcohol as an insidious underground stream of spirits that would kill your grandfather and feel your father's anger and irrigate the Harper family tree.
Yeah. Well, so what I meant by that, of course, is that future generations were often impacted by the alcohol thing. And I have a couple of siblings who are alcoholics, or, you know, they don't drink anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I think all of us, and I think it's safe to say that all of me and my siblings, we can see alcoholism in our future if we allowed it to, or allowed ourselves to go there.
Sure.
It's a thing that we all kind of enjoy, shall mm-hmm. we say.
Sure.
And sometimes to excess. So we have to keep it in check. It really is a sort of a, you know, it's not a nice thing to inherit, but there it is.
It gets put in DNA. I mean, it's like, can it
Oh, yeah, it's passed down
like
luggage, right? Yeah. It's
yeah.
No, and it's something that we talk about a lot on the show too, because it's different for everyone, but yet it's such a common thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is. But we have a grip on it now, I think, mm-hmm. me and my siblings.
Oh, that's good.
Hopefully.
You don't want to say anything on the subject.
You know, I live down in New Orleans part time, and I've got a little place down there, and I've started going. But 4 years ago, I moved down there, and I love it so much, but I gotta say, it has turned me into a drinker. That time.
I don't blame you. I don't blame you.
I love.
It's called Bourbon Street, for God's sake.
Yeah, right.
What
exactly.
are you supposed to do? Yeah. Not drink bourbon?
It would be rude. It would be rude, frankly. Yeah,
I know. It is against the culture.
It's definitely turned me
totally
into more of a drinker.
I can totally see that. When I was down there, I went down there for Jazz Fest with my daughter, and we had a cocktail or two.
What'd you think of it?
It was fabulous.
It's my favorite place on earth.
Great vibe.
Really great vibe, yeah. I've been able to enjoy it from visiting you a bunch down there, which is great. And the first time I went there was a complete culture shock. I didn't expect it.
Yeah.
But also, I don't drink. Seeing how much booze is around everywhere, I was like, really? You know, I'm always like, I can't, what are you?
I just love, though, that you can pull out a cocktail at any time of day, pretty much in any place, and no one will give you the hairy eyeball.
No, any venue.
Like, I'm sure. It's party all the time.
Now, there's another message from John Grant, which is, I think, a very important, serious one, as usual.
Hi, Jessica. My name is John Grant, and I have burnt off a few calories since my last question. And I was just wondering that since we've established that you are from the Midwest, you must have been to a potluck dinner at some point in your life. And what is your favorite type of casserole? Thank you.
You know, my mother used to make this casserole, which I have not eaten since the 60s, but it features fettuccine-ish noodles, a Midwestern translation of fettuccine.
Oh, sure.
So like egg noodles from a box or something.
Yeah.
And then you mix it with Campbell's mushroom soup, and then you throw in a can of drained tuna fish. And then you mix all that together, and then you put it in a thing, and then across the top you crumble up potato chips.
Oh.
And then you bake it until it bubbles. And if you're a child in the 60s on a cold winter night in Winnetka, Illinois, it's the best thing you've ever tasted.
That sounds pretty good.
That sounds delicious.
It does.
I would go for some right now. I'd put it away.
I know that you have limited time left, so I want to see Jake, if there's anything left that you wanted to chat about.
I just want to thank you for coming today.
Yeah.
I want to thank you.
Yeah.
It's so fun to talk to you guys.
If you ever want to do this again, we'd be more than happy to have you again, because there's so many other things to talk about.
Oh, when you do the show about shock treatment or something.
Oh, if you would participate in that, that would be amazing. Really, seriously.
I'm a local girl. I go places.
That would be fantastic.
Which part of town do you? I mean, not that it's any of my business. But are you in West or East or
kind of in the middle, up in the hills?
Yeah,
yeah. Awesome. It's up near Mulholland Drive.
Oh, cool.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah, we have a view.
Is your heart really in LA? I mean, do you? It's not like you, because I've been away for the summer. I've been gone for the last 2 months, and I've really just coming back. I've felt a little homesick for it here, which I never thought. But
I think I could say I occasionally feel homesick. I think I feel homesick for my home and my dog and my and my husband and my daughters too, but they're gone. So,
but if you lived somewhere else, do you feel like it would just be the same kind of feeling?
No, I've never felt when I first came here for that audition a million years ago, and I looked around at the plants. And I felt like I was on Mars, because I'm such a maple tree, oak tree girl.
Okay.
And there was all this weird foliage. It just made me feel like an alien, and I felt that way ever since. But I have to say, there are times when I'm really great. You know, it's beautiful. Many parts of it are very beautiful. And, you know, my kids grew up with a lawn and they're backyard.
Yeah.
So that's nice. Can't do that in New York. But I do miss New York a lot. Now we have a little place there and we go back and forth a lot. So.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah.
Because my daughter's there and I love New York.
What part of town are you in Manhattan?
Now I'm in Upper West Side.
Oh, awesome. Beautiful.
Yeah. Near the park. So.
It's so funny. I'm back on my old block on 12th Street. I sold my house here in Los Feliz.
12th Street?
12th between A and B.
Oh, okay. I lived over there for a while, 12th between 1 and 2, I think.
So right there.
Yeah.
Right at the Millennium, I was living there. I was in, you know, finishing school, and it's so funny because I just sold my house here in LA, and I'm just kind of living out of my suitcase at the moment and just bouncing around, and
he's working on some things.
Working on things in various places.
Right.
And But yeah, I'm sort of back on my old block with my friends who I've always had that are still there, and the same people are, a lot of the same people are still around.
Yeah.
So that's been a full circle moment for me.
It's kind of a good feeling, the full circle.
Yeah.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. It's a great feeling, and it's very comforting to be back there. But I've been missing LA a little bit too as well.
Yeah.
I just like driving, and I like, you know.
Yeah, and I've missed you.
Oh, I've missed Craig.
And I've gotten to enjoy a lot of New York recently. I never really got to spend a lot of time in it before. And now I've spent like a couple weeks at a time. And actually, you were in town then and stuff. So I've sort of gotten to get a relationship with New York now. I'm originally from Massachusetts, but now visiting from here, it's a whole different thing, which is nice. But I know you have to go, so I want to wrap up.
No one else and... to love you. No one else to love you.
You know that I still love you.
In my different keys.
Wait, do that again. In my own way.
And I'll do it. Know that I still love you. You know that I still love you. Know that I still love you.
Dun, 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 dun.
In my own way.
Oh my God.
Can't get much more beautiful than that. Well, thank you so much, Jessica.
Thanks so much for having me. It was fun.
If only you knew how to win some prizes. If only you knew how to play. If you could sleep nights, stop your crying. If that's not enough, then I am so sorry I met you. It was almost like leading you on. But there's more to it all than just ringing your heart out over something that keeps on going wrong. So don't tell me. If you're falling apart at the seams, I hope that you smile when you reach your conclusion. I hope that you know just what to say. But if it should mean that the party is over, you should know that I still love you.
For more, head on over to patreon.com/Craig and Friends, sign up, and slide on in to the Thunderbuns of Hot Dog Club.